cities do new media represent? And, well, we'll go, let's start there, and then we'll look at what it brings them, what it's actually brought them.
Well, first of all, let me say hello to all you guys out there. It's nice to be in class. You should all know that I'm actually taking graduate courses myself now, so I just got done with midterms 2 weeks ago, so this is my official spring break, so I know what it's like to be in student mode. That's something that I decided to do after, you know, spending a lot of time in the White House with Bill Clinton. I decided I should probably go get a theology degree, so that's what I'm actually doing now to atone for my sins. But you know, that it strikes me, thinking about that 10 years ago when I left the White House, is a much different environment from where things are now. And I've talked to Robert Gibbs, who is currently President Obama's press secretary, a lot about how different his job is from the one that I had. It is, you know, Martha's question is just like, if you had asked me, what's your new media strategy 10 years ago, only 10 years ago at the White House, I'd say, what are you talking about, you know? But the changes that are happening in the media, and the fact that we've seen so much churning in the media environment, and the disaggregation of a national audience that no longer follows exclusively what we call mainstream media, means that any White House that wants to have kind of an effective strategy for reaching out to the American public has to develop some way to go to all these new engines of involvement, engines of engagement that exist on the internet, which are Facebook, yes, you know, increasingly other sources, blogs that I think are influential, that people who are in the political realm listen to. But one way or another, all of them involve, you know, using electronic media to reach out and create a dialogue with other people. That's a lot different from, you know, putting one-way information in front of the media, which has been the traditional model of White House communications. You put out a press release, you put out an event, you put out something, and you transmit the information to the public. Now, increasingly, these new media strategies involve engaging, interacting, involving your audience, and I think that's a very important distinction. I think that's something that the new design of the White House communications apparatus has to take into account, that. And Obama really probably is the first White House presidency that's really actively engaging those parts, because it's literally brand new. We're inventing something that hasn't existed before, as Martha Kumar is the expert on.
Well, you know, you look at all that the effort that they've put out on doing Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, all of those various things, and you look at the healthcare debate, and you see that you see public opposition to something that is going to benefit the middle class, and you see in some polls where if people are asked aspects of the healthcare proposal, they're in favor of it, and yet yet altogether they'll say that they're against it. And that seems to me to be some failure of communications, that you spend a lot of time on these various formats, but I don't see what it's gotten them.
Well, they did pass the bill.
Uh-huh.
And they did, you know, I think they made it through an incredibly complicated debate in which the moving parts of the debate were complicated, and they got to a conclusion that no other president has gotten to since Harry Truman. So you've got to give them some credit for having achieved a result. Now, you could argue about whether it's a good result, not a good result, you know, is it going to work, is it not going to work. But it worked in part. I think part of the reason why they, in the end of the day, made it to where they wanted to be is because the conventional way of doing business in the White House has changed. That they were not, if they had been frozen into communicating only with the conventional wisdom of the mainstream media, mm-hmm. allowed day in and day out, they would have given up after what's-his-name got elected in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Because everyone said, oh, it's dead. This is, you know, writing's on the wall. It's all over. But they had an ability to trust instinct and to activate pockets of support that they were able to generate through the internet and elsewhere. And they brought the thing back to life. I mean, that's extraordinary. I think you're onto something here, which is this is a brand new way of thinking about how a White House communicates, because in the past it involved a lot of how you dealt with the conventional mainstream media, but they have inadvertently, I don't think it's been conscious, I think inadvertently they've tapped into the ability to go out and make things happen using the internet, using this new network of grassroots communications that's available to a White House. And I think that's pretty darn interesting. I mean, it's going to change the way in which we think about White House communications over the long term. And it changes the way in which the president communicates. We have a constant debate, and for the students there, you will probably have heard some of this over the course of the semester. You know, can you at one time have four or five different subjects going simultaneously? And there's been a large body of opinion, no, you can't. You know, they're making a huge mistake here. But I think they're beginning to prove that actually they've kept simultaneously a lot of different conversations going on parallel tracks.
Yeah.
And they want them all to begin to start producing results now. So you know, there's a whole body of, there's a large community in this country that cares about nuclear nonproliferation and what's happening in the arms control world and stuff like that. Well, immediately after healthcare reform, they announced a very significant deal with Russia on arms control. Well, you know, that counts for something in this world. So I think we are underestimating their ability to communicate effectively. Like, you know, and I know that the dysfunctions that exist in that operation. But I think if you step back and look, what kind of results are they getting? They're getting more results than we give them credit for.
Well, if you look at Brown's victory in Massachusetts and compare it, it's far more minor, but compare it to the Republicans winning in 94, that energized Clinton in the very same way that Obama seemed to get energized.
Well, it was different.
By a defeat.
It was different. Obama got energized by Brown's victory in Massachusetts, yes. And they had kind of a wake-up call. It was nowhere near the catastrophe that hit the Clinton White House in 1994, in November of 1994, when Bill Clinton suddenly lost control of the entire Congress and then suddenly had to wake up with Newt Gingrich being the Speaker of the House. And I think that was a shock in the system, and it took months, really, for Clinton to overcome that. He was wandering around despondent and debating about whether he was relevant and a lot of other things. This is ancient history for students now, but it took a long time to recover. Now, the recovery of Obama in the aftermath of Brown's victory in Massachusetts was pretty swift.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a kick in the butt, but they moved quickly. And I think part of what we're talking about here, the internet accelerates the response mechanism that exists then. It took a longer time in 1994 going into 1995 to absorb that loss and figure out what to do and make changes to accordingly. But that happened, and eventually Clinton got back on track. What's surprising me is just that, you know, the internet accelerates everything. And so Obama made adjustments, changed his style of presidency. You know, he's at, you know, kicking butt. He's the new macho man now. He's appointing people and doing this and calling people out, and you know, he's using the presidential bully pulpit in the last 2 weeks much differently than what he's done in the past. So there has been a real sea change, and it reflects some of how much the change in the apparatus of communications impacts the White House itself.
Do you think that in part, say with the recess appointments, he couldn't, I mean, even if he had had the opportunity, he couldn't do it before health care.
Yeah.
So that there are a lot of things that they could have thought, well, after health care gets through, then we will adopt this particular style.
He would have been to, you know, to use very, you know, broad brush strokes, he would have been considered too timid to have done those things before health care. Now he is suddenly, you know, the righteous macho man out there doing stuff and making things happen. So it's a weird, almost immediate change in the culture of the place, but uh-huh. It has had a real significant impact, and you feel it when you talk to White House people, as you have, mm-hmm. I'm sure. They sort of feel like suddenly they're on the offensive, and nothing really changed much. It was a very minor tweak in the legislative strategy to how we're going to pass health care, but it just shows you how much these incremental smaller things have an impact on the larger global picture of how we view the White House itself.
Mm-hmm. What about the opportunity that you all have? If you go back, you can see there are lots of changes in environments that presidents have had, from technology, communications technology, like the development of radio, the development of television. You know, were brought about enormous changes in the presidency. But one of the changes beside the internet, but before that, that you all had was cable. CNN was there, but Fox and MSNBC come on in 1996. What difference did that make to you all, and how did you think about it? Did you talk about it as something that represented change?
You know, we didn't, and it's a very interesting and good question, because it reminds you how much the technology has changed so rapidly. But in 1995, when I first decided to allow television cameras to actually air the White House briefing every single day, I never thought to myself, well, one day this will be instantly on cable television, because at that point there was only CNN. And CNN had then about the same ratings it has today, which is to say not many people watched.
Yeah.
So it was not a big deal. Then we had an explosion of interest as more cable outlets came online and a greater audience developed day in and day out. And that did have a real impact. But I think the biggest change is not that, and not that we suddenly had 24/7 instantaneous television coverage of the White House. It's that we suddenly had a medium, the internet, which said, you will only be successful if you engage me and get me to be involved in my environment, because it's an interactive medium. I think unless you get me to sign up and go online or sign up to your Facebook page or sign this petition online, you're really not communicating unless you get me to do something in response to whatever information you're giving to me. That's a radically different model for communications if uh-huh. you're at the White House, because in the past it's been a one-way, we deliver the information, here's the information, how are we going to best get the information to you, how can we best present and shape the information. Now it's about not only what is the information we're giving to you, but what kind of a response are we getting? Are we getting the instantaneous involvement of the audience that we expect? And that's, we had no way to measure that in 1998, except like, well, did our number of phone calls go up? Did our number of letters go up? We gave Bill Clinton lots of letters to read from people who had written, and that was an interactive way, which, by the way, was not inconsequential, because he really did read those letters. But, you know, that's all different now in the internet age, and I think that's the really interesting change that's happened in the last 10 years.
How do you see it coming back into the White House, like, for example, with the president?
Well, I think there's a lot more interactivity, a lot more acknowledgement of what's happening online. I think I've been told by my friends who are at the White House now that President Obama is much more attuned to what is the electronic measure of responses that they're getting on the web and certain things. He's very interested in what kind of comments they get online to his Saturday message, which we used to call it the Saturday radio address. It's not
right.
The Saturday radio address anymore, because it's a multimedia platform. So I think they are indicating that they are more responsive and hearing more about what kind of reaction they're getting. And I think that's, I think it's good in small d uh-huh. democratic terms, because it's giving a more of a input from regular citizens. But it really does make the job a much different. The job of kind of running White House communications is a much different job now in many ways.
Yeah. I know that the first town hall, I think they called it a town hall, that was from the East Room, that was on the Internet, and they were taking issues that people wanted the president to respond to. I think the issue that came up on the top five was legalizing marijuana.
Yeah.
So you knew that what had happened is that a lot of people, you know, organized and sent a lot of emails. So how do you know the system that you're creating is one that's really reflective?
Well, good point. We're in this hybrid area, which is, you know, I didn't go online to kind of interact with President Obama on that occasion. So the only thing we know about that is from the more traditional media, what we call uh-huh. mainstream media, which reported on it later. So I think that we're in this hybrid area in which the conventional news sources that we rely upon, the major networks, the big newspapers, are still going to have a very important role in telling us what's really happening day in and day out, because they're still a much valued resource. And frankly, if you're over age 50, you trust those sources more than you trust other sources, so we're going to hear from them. But the other thing that's going to happen is that we're going to see more of the involvement through these online news sources that I think are going to become increasingly important to people, and we're going to have more of them involved in the dialogue on a day-in and day-in uh-huh. day-out basis, and that's going to be a big change.
It looks like when you read so many of them, what you get is a focus on the stories that come from the New York Times or the Washington Times or the, you know, LA Times. It's using traditional newspapers.
Well, because those are the best reporters. If mm-hmm. you right now, maybe some of the students that are hearing us tonight are actually involved in journalism or interested in a career in that. But right now, the best jobs in journalism are still at the Washington Post, the New York Times, the venerable elites of the national mm-hmm. media. That's changing, because they're going to change too. I mean, 10 years from now, I don't know whether the Washington Post will still exist or not. I don't know whether I don't know whether the New York Times will exist. If you look at who's more precarious financially, it's probably the New York Times, because the Washington Post is basically a company that sells testing services.
Yeah.
Any of those of you who took Kaplan courses, you actually contributed to the Washington Post's ability to gather news and report news, because that's how they make their money now. The New York Times doesn't have that, and they may be out of business in 10 years unless they sell to Google or somebody.
Uh-huh.
So I think those economic transformations are going to be really, really critical, and I think that is going to impact the way in which journalism happens, and which and how White Houses organize themselves to tell their story and get out there. I lost track of what the question was, because I kind of got off into this reverie on
no, that's fine.
Google buying the New York
yeah.
Times.
But. Yeah, but that it's the it is those mainstream news organizations.
Oh, yeah.
Who are the ones that are really
yes.
providing. Huffington Post is bringing you pieces from.
Right.
They have some of their own, but they online sources don't have
right.
the funds.
That's my point. The best reporters that really know this stuff and cover the White House well still work for the traditional mainstream organizations.
Yeah.
They are the Washington Post, New York Times, the major broadcast networks. But increasingly, you see people like Politico. .com and others who are more online platforms beginning to invade that space. So the reason that I think that the more traditional mainstream news organizations set the pace is because the best reporters are there.
Mm-hmm.
I think if the best reporters start migrating to the new platforms, then that's where you're going to see the real path-breaking work done. And that started, some of that is starting to happen already. I mean, we kind of, in the political world, we wake up every day and read a thing called The Playbook by Mike Allen, who is on Politico, which is a very important level-setting thing for everybody of, you know, what's going on today. And I think a lot of people now read that before they pick up and read The Washington Post in the morning, which is a big, big change in the way in which we consume information.
One of the things that Playbook is particularly important, seems to me, on politics.
Yeah.
That it's very good on it, but on substantive policy, you just don't,
that's
you know,
right.
Like if you have a big article, I remember the New York Times had a big article on debt, on the national debt, and that didn't appear.
Right.
Another, which I thought was a very interesting piece that Karen DeYoung did, talking about the drones and whether, what are the advantages and disadvantages of using drones? Because you get to you kill your enemies in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but you don't then get the information that you might have gotten if you'd captured them. But there are a lot of other issues if you captured them that you'd have to deal with. That those kinds of thought-provoking pieces are not something they're going to pop up in Playbook.
No, they're not. But over time, the online platforms may be the ones that have got the profit mechanism that can actually subsidize that kind of journalism. So I don't rule out the possibility that both of those pieces were absolutely fabulous. So a front page New York Times story about really what's going to happen with the structure of the federal deficit in the aftermath of the health care bill that nobody could have written on the fly for a blog or for some online source. And then the one that you mentioned from the Washington Post that Karen DeYoung wrote about the drones. Both, by the way, well, the second one is a Pulitzer Prize-winning story, I think. It has that capacity. But that kind of journalism is going to have to be repositioned and presented to us in the new format and new vernacular that's going to exist in the world we live in. Now, it's not going to be print on paper coming to us in the form of a newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post. It's going to be in a converged medium that attracts a big audience, including old fogies like me that still like to read newspapers, but you know, younger people like my kids that, you know, would not think of reading a newspaper, but they would read interesting content online. So how do you get that interesting content in front of them? All of this, by the way, what is something that I know at the White House, they say, how are we going to shape the way in which we get our message out every day? Because we can't rely upon the more traditional ways in which we're doing business.
One of the things that seems to me that they've been able to do that has been difficult, increasingly difficult, is that they, because there is a kind of a fracturing of the media, that people are going to things that places that they get news that they want to read. And so they target particular groups. Like, for example, President Obama does a lot of interviews, many more interviews than President Clinton or Bush. And I think in part he does that because he's targeting specific audiences. So he's done quite a few with Latino news organizations, mostly radio and television. And there he talks about different subjects. So he's been talking about immigration throughout his presidency, even though it's not been something of discussion in the mainstream media. But while he has done that, that he has sometimes found a vehicle that that President Bush didn't have, and an opportunity, and even I think President Clinton, is in his first year, he had four nighttime news conferences that the networks were allowed him an hour four times, which is not only unusual, it hasn't happened before. So there he gets to get to a national audience and to have a national moment, that in spite of all the fractured audiences there are, that he's still been able to create times when he's brought people together. And they've used 7 minutes at the beginning of each one of those. And so he's been able in that 7 minutes to bring people together, have them listen and talk to everyone at the same time. Because if you look at the number of people that have watched the Nielsen ratings, I think for his first press conference were 49 million.
Yeah.
And even his last one, I think, was 20, 22 or so.
Well, look, he is a compelling historic figure, and he gets that kind of audience, and he did early on. But the networks gradually, I think, made the decision, you know, we're just giving this guy a platform for him to come on and make his statement, whatever it is, to have his message out. And that's not what we're about. We're about interactive dialogue, and I think they began to weigh the cost of putting those press conferences on versus their traditional programming and the advertising revenues they get. And they made the decision saying, I think that they said, we're not just going to carry these opportunities for Obama to come out and give his message unfiltered, particularly because the press doesn't seem to push him that hard in these sessions. So I think we've seen, you know, a real transformation of that primetime press conference. That was the granddaddy platform for the presentation of the president's views. But I don't think we can, you know, unless we have when we had Obama in the first half of the first term was a compelling national figure, and you wanted to say, what's this guy going on now? You know, what's going on with him? Once we sort of figured out, okay, here's how he's operating as president, we know kind of what he's about, the urgency of doing that primetime press conference began to subside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the White House milked it as long as they could, but then
yeah.
they figured out, well, we can't keep this thing going, so that's why they've reverted back to doing more interviews. I think it's your data that you've developed, which is, you know, a wonderful piece of research and scholarship about the differences between the presidents
yeah.
and how they do it. It reflects that Obama has to deal with the disaggregated audience. He can't call everyone together to come around to the village campfire every night to hear the story told,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way you would in a village in Africa or the way we would do electronically in the era of the conventional mainstream media. That doesn't exist anymore. So he's got to deal with this disaggregated way in which we communicate, which is why he does more of these interviews with specific niche publications that will reach specific audiences. And I think I think it's working for them. I mean, I think they continue to hold a base and a base of support, but they still are going to be buffeted by whatever is the larger storyline of who's up, who's down in the White House. And right now, having passed health care, they're on a high note. So they're, you know, reaping the benefit of that,
mm-hmm.
I think.
And while he's been focusing a lot on interviews, as 161 in his first year, he has had very few short Q&As. And I think those, in part, it's because he's not very good at it. He needs a longer form where he's explaining things. He's a former professor, and we don't talk.
You're talking
in short
45-minute increments.
That's right, so. Or an hour and a half.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, he is
and a lawyer.
Uniquely, between compared to his predecessors, President Bush and President Clinton, he does not do many of these interactive, let's throw the cameras open and I'll take a few of your questions kinds of environments. But I think that's also because two things. One, the White House knows that's not a good environment for him to communicate. I think you're right about that that's not a good form for him. And secondly, they don't pay a price for saying no. In my time, mm-hmm. if we had said, no, we're not going to do any Q&A at that thing, the press would have gone berserk and I would have had Helen Thomas beating, pummeling me under my desk,
uh-huh.
you know, trying to beat me into submission, you know, and that frankly, the ability of the press corps to command that kind of performance doesn't exist anymore because their influence has declined. So I think they get away with a lot more that I frankly never would have gotten away with.
What would have happened to you beside Helen complaining and Sam Donaldson and
others. It would have been.
Because they complain. Helen complains. It's
but just the regulars in the press corps would have made that the only issue, and it would have impeded our ability to communicate. I think what the press corps, they're many of the same people who are the venerable mainstays, they now say, you know, We can't threaten this White House anymore. We don't have the power to threaten it. What are we going to take away? Their audience? Well, we don't have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the circulation. We don't have the same ability to intimidate the White House that existed 10 years ago, because we're frankly in decline, and they all know it. So they have to kind of be more meek and humble and play by the rules. Now, I you can argue, I'm sure, if there are any Republican Tea Party members in our class here, they'll say, well, that's exactly what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about politics. It's really about the transformation that's been happening in the media. And it is a really interesting problem, because for right now, the White House has got more ability to control its own coverage, but less of ability to, as you say, command the national audience and get people to understand what they're about. So it's a fragmented audience, but they've got more control over a fragmented audience.
Uh-huh. But they lose something, too, by not having the president ready to answer questions.
Yeah, they lose.
Because,
I mean, he's ready to answer questions.
But when he does an interview, he's going to do an interview on a subject. Like if he's doing an interview with David Leonhardt, he's going to be talking about the economy.
Yeah. So he knows what environment he's going into.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's not that they settle the questions beforehand. It's just that they know what kinds of issues are going to come up. Or let's say last week we had April Ryan. And so she talked about her interview with the president. Well, when they had her, and then they had Roland Martin, and they had Tavis Smiley all around the same time, you knew what they were doing. They were setting up his opportunity to talk to black audiences. So there can be certain kinds of questions that come up, black unemployment, the farmers, the black farmers, you know, and a whole group of issues. So they can set them up for that.
Well, you're right about one thing. You miss in the press conference or in the environment in which you haven't kind of carefully structured what the environment's going to be. You miss those beautiful, delicious moments in which the president has to think on his feet.
Yeah.
And for Clinton, you know, those were some of the most rewarding, interesting, sometimes dangerous moments for the press secretary, when he was actually going to be out there and have to take the unanticipated question and actually show a little bit of his thought process and how he was addressing a question. And I think that's very valuable for Americans to see that. This will sound too partisan, but when I saw that happen with George Bush, sometimes I said, man, does this guy really, is he connected to what's going on in the world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Clinton sometimes you'd say, man, does this guy, he is like way overdosed on too much information, because he didn't, you know, he'd just start talking and it'd go on for 45 minutes. So there was a very interesting juxtaposition, but those impromptu, unstructured moments seem to be coming fewer and fewer. That's the one price we're paying for this environment we're in, because the White House can control every single question.
I remember a time where, I don't remember what year it was, but Carl Cannon asked a question that dealt with China, and China had not been on the scope at all. And so when you looked at Clinton's face, you saw that he hadn't prepared for that question, and he was absolutely delighted. And so you did get that view, and that's one of the, from a citizen's point of view, one of the advantages of a press conference is to see how a president will respond.
Well, I can tell you, being the press secretary who sat there and prepared the president, you know, we took hours preparing for these press conferences, but the most interesting questions and responses were the ones that we never did rehearse in advance, that we didn't anticipate. And sometimes, even if it was a subject that we anticipated, someone would pose a very interesting way to get into the subject that we hadn't thought of, and that was actually a point which you could sit back and say, well, I've got a president who actually is thoughtful and will address this question in a very interesting, thoughtful manner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's very, very important. And I think I don't discount President Bush in his ability to do some of that, although I think he was less structured in the way in which he kind of went out and got information and absorbed it intellectually. I think he had a different style of his presidency. And Obama, I think, is very different, too. I think he's a very linear thinker. He's more like, in some ways, he's more like Bush than Clinton, you know, in his way in which he kind of is a linear way of approaching the presidency. I'll probably get in trouble for having made that comparison, but I think it's just interesting. They have different styles.
Yeah, but a major difference between Presidents Obama and Bush is that President Bush did not see his role as being one of explanation. He believed he should answer questions, but that he should answer questions simply because that was an aspect of a democratic political system.
He believed in strong executive leadership and said, I am the president, I am going to decide, I'm the great decider, and I will move the country in the direction we need to go. And sometimes he's right. Sometimes we need a president like that. I think Obama is much more of, I need to help us understand, and my job is to educate and to bring people to the same place, and then I can, you know, sort of indicate, here's where we need to go and move ahead. Clinton was very different, was a consensus builder. I want everybody to come together and hear what we have to say to each other and understand each other, and then we can collectively decide how to move forward. And that was more inchoate as a way of leading, but it was a, he did lead, and he led, I think I'd argue, he led reasonably effectively. But there were three very different styles of leadership. That's a great subject for if someone wants to write a, you know, political science paper.
That is, that is interesting. Those three presidents have had very different atmospheres to work in, and you've worked on the Hill, you've worked in campaigns, you've worked at the State Department and the White House, and you've worked since you got out of college. In
the good, the bad, the ugly.
So compare the environment then and now, and what difference does it make? What was the Senate like then, and how do you see it now? And what difference does it make to the presidency and for what it is a president can do?
This is the point at which my kids always roll their eyes and said, Dad, you're so boring. But I did get my first job out of college more than almost 35 years ago now. So I'm like, I started working in that environment on Capitol Hill before many of the students here were born. And it was a much different place, different style, tempo, culture in Washington. So that's been a big change. But the primary difference between being at the White House and being all those other places is, at the White House, you have a confined press corps that is going to cover what you do day in and day out, no matter what. So that you have got to figure out what news are we generating today or not generating, and how are we going to deal with the appetite that this press corps has for news. When you work on Capitol Hill, you're with, you know, 535 people who are competing against each other to make news. So people will go to histrionic lengths to try to create news and do something that compels attention by the media. And that's a different environment. It's a different job. You have to kind of like make news as opposed to manage news. And I think those are critical differences. Now, in my other experiences, when I worked at the State Department, you had people who were going to cover you every day, but what you were saying was about a global conversation that involved diplomacy. So you were involved in public diplomacy, much different from managing the ups and downs of the daily flow of information, you know, at the White House or in the political world. So they are all very different jobs. And I know, you know, probably there are people taking this class who would think about maybe working in public information or politics and doing the kind of things I've done in my career. It's, you know, recognize how different all of those different career choices are, and the environment in which you work is really different depending on what the needs of the office are. So, but my takeaway is that through all of it, you have to always be very clear about what you're trying to communicate and be very relentless in focusing your ability to get your message across, regardless of what the environment is in which you're communicating. Now, the environment generally is, you know, it sucks today. It's a much more poisonous, bitter, partisan environment, and it's, nobody's very happy with Washington, and things are, you know, not particularly wholesome in the way in which we think about our ability to govern ourselves politically. But I think that will change over time, and I think that changes. I think that's a reflection of the economic times that we face. So I think that evens itself out over time. I think what endures is the challenge in the technology environment that we're in, and the rapid change of the media itself is figuring out ways to take your information that's important and get people to pay attention to it. Believe it or not, you know, government, politicians, people in Washington have got important information that they need to get out to the public. I mean, we're spending a lot of money. We're making a lot of decisions that impact people's lives. We have got to do a better job of telling that story and keeping people well-educated. And I think that primarily is what the function of a White House press secretary or anyone working in, you know, press jobs in the various parts of government should be about. And we ought to think about that more deliberately than we do, I think.
So they're important continuities.
Yes.
That even though there's an enormous amount of change,
well,
there's a continuity in what the public needs.
One continuity is the public's right to know. There is such a thing as the public has a right to know what its elected leadership is about and doing. And people who have jobs like the one I have, we are the custodians of that. We should be advocating for the public's right to have more information. And I think that's functionally what a press secretary at the White House should always be about, is being on the side of those who want more transparency, more information, more getting the story out. Because there are good reasons politically sometimes to, you know, try to keep things contained. And so and any White House, any president has to make those choices. But someone needs to be an advocate for that public information function. And I think that's the job of the press secretary.
Yeah. Well, today our session's going to be a little shorter than it normally is. It's going to be 7, when we're going to stop at 7. So I'd like to bring the students in now. But you all, anybody got a question?
You guys will have to perform, because Martha and I are looking at an empty classroom here. Is this right after spring break or something?
I don't know. They may be on spring break. I'm not sure if they're on spring break.
Did you guys just
here.
Have spring break, or are you on spring break? Maybe whoever asked the first question out there can answer that question for me. But we need one of you to be brave and go to the microphone and ask a question.
Yeah. Come on, guys.
Nobody's jumping at the opportunity. You know, what I used to do in a situation like this was I would call on someone. So I'm going to call on the guy who's in the front of the classroom on the right in the striped shirt. Since I can see you, you have to ask the first question. So think of one.
Yeah, we can't hear it.
They're going to boost the volume on you, I think.
No. Still can't.
Due to technical difficulties, there is a pause in our program. Is there one mic in the room out there?
Yeah, there are mics all around there that they should be able to use. Can somebody else try one? Yeah. Is there anything we need to turn on here?
Hey, do you have, can they text you a message?
Oh.
Do you guys have Martha's telephone number? Someone can text her a message.
Yeah, send me an email.
Text her a question.
Yeah, I'll call my, they should have the number also here, if they can call me.
If you send it to Joint Kumar, JOYNTKUMAR, @AOL.com, It will come in. You can text it.
In the meantime, you guys can take a vote. You want to hear more Monica Lewinsky stories? You want to hear? You want to hear?
What did you? Since you mentioned her, what did you?
Since I brought the subject up.
Yeah. What did you find as the challenge in dealing with that issue, and how did you keep it out of the briefing room?
Well, you guys would be hard pressed to remember this, but you've probably heard about it at the time. But this was a consuming subject in 1998 for all of 6 months, when the business about Clinton having had an alleged affair with, an affair with one of the interns working on the White House staff became kind of a principal preoccupation of the White House press corps for months, even though they tried to turn the subject to something else. And my job as press secretary was, one, don't dig the hole deeper, so don't say a lot of things that will compound the problem by trying to defend Clinton when you don't know what the facts are. I didn't know the facts, and we elected not to talk to Clinton personally about it, because then we all would have had subpoenas or, you know, had to testify ourselves about anything that he told us. So we held the line at a very kind of non-committal statement about, here's, you know, it's under investigation, so we can't talk about it further. But I also, at the time, created a unit that would respond to the issues the press was raising about this. And my argument was, you and the press have got your own investigative reporters spending full time on this, so we at the White House will have our own response mechanism working on this full time. So you go talk to the people who are there to respond to you, and then we'll deal with all the other subjects that are here at the White House briefing room every day. And I think that helped diffuse a little bit of the tension every day. And it also gave the reporters covering the White House an opportunity to say, hey, they're not going to tell us anything here. Can we go cover some other story? Because three or four months later, most of them were sick and tired of the story, just like the rest of the country was, and they wanted to, quote unquote, move on to something else. Mm-hmm. And so I think it actually did work to help us get over the subject and get into other things. But then, of course, it became very partisan. The Republican Party decided that they were going to impeach President Clinton for not being truthful in one of his testimonies in front of a grand jury, and then that kind of kept the story going longer than it was officially over, I think.
One of the things that we've talked a bit around is transparency and the growing amount of pressure there is for information, and also I think the commitments that presidential candidate Barack Obama made about transparency. And do you think that that we really do have a lot more transparency than we used to? And what does it bring us?
Well, I think we do have more transparency. The unfortunate fact is there's so much more information that we have to manage that it doesn't seem like we've made any progress, because the quantity of information grows faster than our ability to make it transparent. And that's like one of the big challenges that exists. But I think this president has been more committed to opening up processes of government. I think they have done some things that at the margin, and not in a huge way, but at the margin, have made the White House somewhat more accessible to the public than the previous president, and probably more accessible than when I was there with President Clinton. And I think that's all to the good. I think they've done more work to put things online, make things available to people who can use the technology that was really, you know, frankly, 10 years ago, we were still just learning how to use the Internet more effectively. Google didn't exist 10 years ago when I was at the White House. So we were just getting to the point where we could start to, you know, make things more transparent electronically. And I think now, fast forward to where we are today, I think they've been very effective in in opening up and making more things available, and I think that's a good thing. But look, for the massive quantity of information, we still need ways in which we can focus it and make it useful to people, and that's the role of the media. And I think the media is still catching up to where they need to be to make things happen.
Yeah. One last question.
Yeah, it doesn't look like, I'm sorry, you guys, doesn't look like we're technologically able to talk to you, but if you got any great, I'll give Martha my email address. If you had a burning question that you said, I got to get this guy McCurry to answer this question, she'll have my email address and she can send a question to me. I'm happy to help you out.
What is the biggest challenge from moving from campaigning to governing in a White House?
Ooh.
And do you see them making the Obama White House making adjustments, and how have they been doing that?
Well, it's interesting that they are two different functions. To run a campaign communications apparatus is about controlling a contest that exists with your opponent day in and day out, to manage a storyline that comes out to your advantage. Governing is different because there's no day-to-day opponent. Yes, there's an opposition party. Yes, there are Republicans that are trying to shoot at you and, you know, bring your program down. But it really is about you advancing your agenda and program, and so the American people will find it acceptable. So you lose the benefit of having the foil, having the opponent out there. And this is interesting because presidencies flounder when they get to the point where we're here, we have to govern, we have an agenda, we have to make stuff happen. When there's a real crisis, like 9/11 or like FDR faced maybe with the Great Depression, you can galvanize a country and move it forward because things are so urgent. Mm-hmm. But absent that, then you are struggling to try to create momentum and create the storyline day in and day out that worked for you the way it did during the election. And the other problem is that you tend to have people populating the higher ranks of your White House that were great at campaigning because they helped you get elected, but they are not as skilled at governing. And we've had a surfeit of stories here in Washington about Rahm Emanuel, who was not one of Obama's campaign aides, but a very skilled, talented guy who becomes chief of staff and who helps govern. And, you know, what is his role as chief of staff? There's been a lot of, you know, back and forth about that. So I think the transition is a very difficult one. And usually what happens right about now, and it's starting to happen now, is that the people who were good at the campaign activities begin to fall by the wayside, and the people who are actually better and more skilled at the governing and what does it take to actually, you know, promulgate a program here in Washington, they begin to rise to the fore. And so you see a natural transition that begins to happen. It is also true that sometimes a crisis provokes that. For Clinton in 94, it was losing control of the House and the Senate and suddenly having to, you know, wake up and say, now I've got a whole do business in a whole different way. I think Obama has had a little bit of that because of some of the things, the controversy over health care, but he will get a big challenge at some point, even bigger than probably he's had now, in some fashion, and then that galvanizes a presidency too. But I think they're in the process now, you know, almost 2 years into the presidency, of making that adjustment. And beginning to sort of say, hey, this governing thing is different from the way in which we campaign for office. And, you know, it'll help his presidency as they go through that transition.
Uh-huh. And then, two, they work, it looks like they work pretty much a seven-day week, and that people are going to burn out.
They work, even in my time in the White House, I always took Sunday completely off. I mean, I just did not even go in the office if I didn't have to, and I don't sense that any of Obama's people get to take a single day off, and that's going to mean that they will burn out early on, so there'll be more turnover. As we get at the end of this year, I expect a number of them to leave. In fact, I got to believe my friend Rahm Emanuel will leave, you know, as soon as we get through the midterms. And you know, a bunch of the other ones will probably leave too, just because it's hard to do those jobs that long. So.
Yeah, and then they find people around Washington that they see doing a good job on policies, and that, like, I think of it in Carter's case, his transitioning in the public liaison area from Mitch Costanza. She just died.
Yes, recently, right.
I was thinking about that. That she, in a sense, came off the campaign, and then he found he needed somebody to organize interest groups who really knew Washington.
He brought in Ann Wexler,
who was absolutely terrific at that. So that kind of adjustment is something that
I think we'll see some of that happen.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it.
It's always nice to be with you. And I'm sorry I'm not with you guys out there. But again, I really do. Someone's holding up a. Someone's got a question there. It looked like they were trying to hold up there. If we could get it, focus in on the camera, we can see it. We can't see it.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, anyhow, it was very nice being with you guys. And I'm more than happy to kind of do a return appearance by email if there are any questions, like I said, that any of you have.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Yeah.